Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Most of us like to think that we are rational, but the fact is that we are more prone to irrational behavior than we realize. There are psychological forces at work in the world that can derail rational thinking, and they creep up on us when we are most vulnerable. They can affect our careers, our finances, even our personal relationships. This morning, in this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Ori Brofman. He is the co-author of a book entitled Sway, The Irresistible Pull of Irrational Behavior. It is a book that he's co-authored with his brother, Ram Brofman, who is a psychologist in private practice in California. And the book takes a look at why it is that sometimes smart people do stupid things and why, well, maybe it's really not their fault, or I should say our fault. Questions and comments are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest, Ori Brofman, is also co-author of another book titled The Starfish and the Spider. He's a well-known organizational expert and speaks often before big companies and military audiences. He's a graduate of the Stanford Business School. He makes his home in San Francisco. He's joining us this morning by telephone. Mr. Brofman, hello.
Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm fine. And how are you?
Doing well.
Good. Thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Maybe I also, I don't think I gave the phone numbers here. Maybe I better do that because, of course, questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana and toll-free 800-222-9455. Is this something, this particular subject, is it something that you've been interested in for a while now? Or was there something in particular that drew you to this?
Both. The subject has been really interesting for me, and the book really has its genesis when I was in business school. You'd have all these case studies of CEOs and companies, very, very rational people, making what seemed to be huge irrational mistakes. And at the same time I was in business school, my brother Ram was getting his PhD in psychology. And at night, I'd get on the phone with him, and I would just tell him how things were going and share the stories. And he would say, well, you know, there's actually the study that explains exactly what happened in this case with this company, or there is all this academic research that combined our two fields of business and psychology and economics. And what was so interesting about it was that it helped me understand my own work better, but over the years we just continued to have these conversations, and eventually we decided to put in a book because for us it was so interesting how we think we're rational on a daily basis, and we know that there are irrational people out there. But why is it that perfectly rational people, business people, lawyers, judges, doctors, why is it that we make irrational decisions?
Yeah. It seems that one thing that operates here and that's very powerful and that maybe would surprise people, even smart people who work in the financial world or work in business, is that it seems that we're actually very bad at thinking about winning and losing and profit and loss, and that we apparently have a very, very powerful aversion to losing. And as a result, we may make decisions that we think are good because of that, and end up, in fact, paying much too much for something or taking a risk that we shouldn't have, and actually losing because we're losing more because we're afraid of losing a little.
That's exactly right. So we feel the pain of a loss much more intensely than the associated pleasure that we get from a gain. And one of the biggest stories of that happening that we looked at in the book is the case of Jacob Van Zanten. And he was the head of safety for KLM Airlines. And this was the go. This was a celebrity, right? This is the go-to guy. Mm-hmm. He literally was the guy who was training people on how to fly the 747s. He was a legend, and he had just finished leading a safety course, a 6-month safety course, when he was captaining a 747 on the way to the Canary Islands. And in the middle of the flight, he gets a radio call saying that the airport he was heading to had a terrorist threat and that he would be diverted to this very small little airport on this tiny little island. And when he lands, there's all these other planes there, and it's very crowded. But the thing that comes to his mind is this thing called a mandated rest period. And the Dutch government had a rule that said that if you were flying for more than X amount of hours, you needed to take a break. And if you don't, then you could actually not only face a fine, you could face prison time. But what a mandated rest period would mean was that his entire crew would be stuck there overnight, and all the passengers, and that there would be huge, huge, huge delays. And he had this reputation for being on time, so he became very concerned about taking on that loss of being late. And he tries to do everything in his power to get out of this island. He tries to keep the passengers aboard, but the air tower doesn't let him. He tries to refuel early. He tries to call HQ. And ultimately, he does the unthinkable. He's at the edge of the runway. There's a fog that's rolled in, and he can barely see to the end. And without getting tower clearance, he starts taking off. And as he's speeding down the runway, he sees another 747 blocking the runway. And he tries to take off, but it's too late. And he ends up causing the biggest airline disaster in history. More than 580 people die that day. And you think, why would the head of safety make such an irrational decision? And, of course, there were other factors. There was a fog. There was another plane that shouldn't have been there. But still, you have the head of safety taking off without clearance. And what happens is that when we perceive a loss, we go to such extreme measures to avoid it that we sometimes lose everything in the process.
Yeah. And I think that you, in that same section, you encourage people to think about their own lives, or at least I thought about my own lives, because some people would say, well, you know, I don't fly jet aircraft. But people make similar kinds of bad decisions when they're behind the wheels of their own cars. And I'm sure you could get people to say, okay, you just think about a time when you were going someplace and you were late. You were late for an appointment, and you were thinking, "Oh, I'm going to be 5 minutes late," or you know, something like that. And you were on the verge of, and maybe you caught yourself on the verge of making what could have been a very bad decision that could have led to an accident, all over saving, you know, preventing yourself from being 5 minutes late. Well, that's kind of the same thing on a slightly smaller scale, but that kind of thing operates in our daily lives, in probably on a fairly regular basis.
Yeah, you know, I hate being late. And when I'm in the car, I just become this road warrior, you know, and I'm like, why am I speeding this much? Why am I taking really my own safety and unfortunately other people's safety in jeopardy just to avoid being late? And we started out talking about how, you know, especially in these financial times, a lot of people are starting to feel very, very strong pains associated with the stock market, right? And as we're seeing, I mean, the Dow just fell again today. And as we feel the pain of our IRAs going away or our savings going away, we're prone to make irrational decisions because we're so afraid of the losses that we've incurred. And we do a couple of things. The first thing is we try to get back to even, which in a lot of ways we end up acting like a gambler sitting on a blackjack table, right? You lose a couple hundred dollars and say, I'll gamble more until I get back to even and I'll go back to my room. Mm-hmm. And that these are actually times that we shouldn't be making. When you're in that situation, when you're in that car and there's a red light, or when there's someone sitting in back of you honking the horn, and these aren't times to be making very big decisions because we're going to be so easily swayed.
Yeah. I think, you know, and with all due respect to Malcolm Gladwell and the book that he wrote about how sometimes snap decisions actually turn out to be good, I kind of think that maybe, to me, at least what this says is that one of the enemies of good decision-making is impatience. And the more you somehow feel pressure to do something, it seems that then it is more the likelihood that whatever you do will be the wrong thing seems to go up.
That's exactly right. And in fact, in terms of loss aversion, there have been studies that said that the more there is on the line, the more likely we are to get loss averse. And the more likely we are to react irrationally.
It seems that, again, to shift the focus, but that there's something about how the longer that you've been doing something in a particular way, that say the more you're committed to a particular kind of strategy, mm-hmm. that the harder it is to let go of that, But that, again, is the kind of thing that says, well, you know, circumstances do change. And so that it might mean in business or in sports or anything else that the time might come for you to do something differently. But that seems like it's very difficult for us, particularly if whatever strategy we have been adopting in whatever sphere we're talking about has worked for a long time. You know, that doesn't necessarily mean it's always going to work, but it seems that it's very hard for us to change the way we've been doing things if they've worked and we've been doing it that way for a long time.
Right, and the irony of it is that we'd still keep on going, we'd still be committed to the process, even if things haven't been working. There's a study that we look at in the book from Harvard Business School. And this professor, Max Bezerman, has a $20 bill auction that he conducts. And what he does is, on the first day of class, he holds up a $20 bill and it says, this bill is up for auction and there's only one rule. And the rule is that the first place winner gets the $20 bill, but the second person, the person who has the second highest bid, gets nothing, but still has to honor his or her bid.
Mm-hmm.
So the bidding starts, and people think, wow, I can get I can get a $20 bill for $3, of course, and everyone's bidding. And around $12, what typically happens is that people start dropping off, and it just only two bidders remain. And they keep on bidding $12, $13, $14, $15, $16. And around that time, the second place person doesn't want to be the sucker who pays good money for nothing, right? You want to be paying $18 just down the hall, so you keep on bidding. And what happens is that time after time, and again, these are Harvard MBAs, the bill goes up for more than $20, up to a record $204. And imagine paying that much money for a $20 bill. And what happens is that you become so committed to the process that you put on blinders and you just refuse to put on the brakes, or you really can't put on the brakes. And it applies not only in business. You think about politics, for example, with Vietnam is a great example of how LBJ was no longer trying to win the war. He was just so committed to the process, so committed to avoiding that loss of Vietnam, that he kept on sending troops and wasn't able to draw back because he was so committed to the process.
Mm. That's a great story, the story about the auction for the $20 bill. And apparently, he's done this for a long time, and it doesn't matter whether they're students or whether they're big-shot executives who have a lot of experience in business. It works no matter who you are. And it also makes me wonder, for the person who wins, you know, the person who ends up paying $200 for a $20 bill, do they think that they've won something?
Right, quote-unquote wins, right? you can open up a great business paying people getting to pay you $203 for $20. And fortunately, the professor gives all the money away to charity. But the thing is that people ask us oftentimes, how do you define irrational behavior? And is this really irrational? Is this really rational? And the definition that I have for myself is I look at irrational behavior as something that afterwards you scratch your head and you say, what was I possibly thinking? Why did I make this mistake? And you whether it's an MBA or an executive, and by the way, the executives were bidding on $100.
Oh,
right.
Great. We just bump up the ante. So it's, yeah. Well, yeah, you couldn't get an executive to do something stupid for a 20, but for a Franklin, oh, yeah, I guess so.
Well, yeah, and people say, well, you know, if it's only for a dime, let's say you bid, you know, 20 cents for a dime, then, oh, well, you took a 10-cent loss. But if you're bidding a few hundred dollars for a $100 bill, that hurts all of us, no matter how much money we have. But you look back and say, what was I possibly thinking? And that's what's been so interesting for me, is that there are these forces, these underlying psychological forces that have an effect on us without us ever realizing it at the moment. So at the moment, you're not realizing how irrational you're being, and it's only minutes or hours or days later that you scratch your head and you try to reflect and you realize that your decision making was flawed or derailed.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Ori Brafman. He is the co-author, along with his brother, Ram, of the book Sway, The Irresistible Pull of Irrational Behavior. Doubleday is the publisher. The book's out now. It's very interesting. You may want to take a look at it. Questions also are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You have to wonder with these kinds of particular things we've been talking about, and certainly there's a lot more when we talk about some other things, you have to ask this question, well, why? Why is it that our thinking works that way? And in this particular case, say, this business of winning and losing and how we think about what things are worth and how much we're willing to pay for them and what we go through to get them. Why is it, in fact, that we behave in this way?
So one really compelling argument is actually evolutionary. And when you think about loss aversion specifically, let's go back in time 10, 20,000 years. And let's say you're living in a cave, and let's say you're in charge of food for your family, right? And let's say you were able to get some food, whether it's berries or a hunted animal, and you're carrying it back to your family. And you know that if they don't eat, they're going to die. And let's say another animal comes up to you and tries to take away your food, tries to steal your food. You're going to fight over that food almost with your life because you know that so much is at stake. And it's a great instinct to have to basically avoid that loss because it takes so much effort to acquire that food source. And it has such huge implications if you don't have it. And I think that same type of mentality stayed with us in our brains, but it just happened that the world changed. And a lot of these forces, they have rational origins, but it's just that our world has become much more complex or has changed in certain ways where we're thinking about a modern world with a slightly older mind.
Hmm. It seems that also part of this it has to do with the way we calculate the value of something, how it is we decide something, one thing is good and one thing isn't. And there are all sorts of odd things that enter into that. Context enters into it. Maybe how hard we have to work to get that thing. Sometimes it just may be, you know, we don't want to think that we're stupid. So if we pay a whole lot of money for something, we'd better believe that it's worth it or else, you know, what does that say about our judgment? It seems that sometimes, in fact, when it comes to determining the value of things, we're actually not that good.
We're actually really bad. I would go even further. There's something we call value attribution, and that once you assign a value to a person or a thing, it's very difficult to see it in any other way. And the Washington Post did an experiment just about this thing with Joshua Bell, who's this fantastic violinist who sells out in concerts all over the world and is just probably one of the best violinists living today. And Joshua Bell plays a $3.5 million Stradivarius violin. And what the Washington Post did is they asked him to go with that same Stradivarius violin down to the subway and perform in the D.C. subway. The only thing is that instead of wearing his concert regalia, he had to wear a pair of jeans and a baseball cap. And here's this guy, again, one of the best violinists in the world, playing his violin, playing the Bach sonatas and partitas, final accompaniment violin, which is one of the most beautiful, complex pieces written for violin. And he sounds like a world-class violinist, but he doesn't look like one. And person after person just passes him without paying any attention to him whatsoever, without paying mind to him. Only one woman recognizes him, and there's actually a video of this online, and you see her just her jaw dropping. She can't believe that this guy is actually playing in the subway. But about 1,000 people pass him without glancing back, and the only people who did want to stay were little kids, actually. And you see the little kids being dragged by their mom or dad away. And what happens is that when you're in that situation, when you're in a subway and there's someone who looks like a street musician, to our ears, because they look like a street musician, they sound like one as well.
Hmm. We're getting close to the midpoint of the conversation again. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Our guest is Ori Brofman. He's the co-author of the book Sway: The Irresistible Pull of Irrational Behavior. I think it's something else too. It gets back to this, maybe this notion that the harder you have to work for something, perhaps the more risk that you take, maybe the more stressful generally the enterprise is, that whatever is at the end of that, you tend to value that more highly than if getting that thing was easier.
Right, and that when we really think about the process a lot, we pay a lot of attention to the process, and if it was something that comes easy to us, then, well, how important can it be, right? But if something is, if you worked really hard on a project, then you start thinking about all that effort that you did, and it's so hard. There's this thing called sunk costs, and it's so hard to think about things in terms of sunk costs, right? So let's say you're doing a project, and maybe who knows? Maybe it's the Etzel, or maybe it's the it's iterative Prius, right? And let's say it's the Etzel, and it's kind of a flop. You think to yourself, my gosh, I put a lot of effort in this thing, and that it's very difficult to think about if it was today, and forgetting all these expenses that I already put into it, forgetting all the effort, it's gone. Would I still be continuing this project? And when we ask ourselves the question in that way, oftentimes the answer is no. But we still say, well, I've already spent 5 years working on this thing. At least I want it to come to completion.
It's something else, and maybe again, this, I know I'm sort of jumping around here, but it goes back to the sort of the previous example where nobody really thinks the world's greatest violinist is going to be playing in the subway. So you undervalue that person and their performance, but if they were in Carnegie Hall, maybe you think, well, anybody is going to be in Carnegie Hall. Obviously, it must be very good. Our perception of the people that we're dealing with, it's not just context, it also has to do with them. It also affects our judgment. And, that's why for people who appear to be attractive to us or maybe are really good in those kind of situations, those people can be much more persuasive because we're swayed simply by how people present themselves and what they look like.
And where it gets really interesting is that how we perceive them, in turn, has an effect on them, and they start taking on the role that we ascribe to them. So in one of the studies we looked at in the book, it was men and women had to have a very brief phone conversation, and these men and women never met each other. So in preparation for this phone conversation, the men were shown pictures of the women that they would be talking to. And half the men were shown pictures of very, very attractive women, and the other half were shown pictures of less attractive women. Now, the only thing is that, and the men didn't know this, is that the pictures were actually fake. They had nothing to do with how the real women looked like. So then the men have this conversation with the women, and the women had no idea that any picture had been shown, beautiful or otherwise. And they just have conversations about the weather and classes and school and what have you. And afterwards, what the researchers did is they cut out the voices of the men, and they just had left the voices of the women talking on the phone. And they let a third objective group just listen to the conversation. And remarkably, the women who the men thought were attractive ended up sounding attractive on the phone, regardless of how they actually looked. And the women who the men thought were not attractive ended up sounding not as attractive on the phone. So just because someone thinks you're beautiful, even if it's on the phone, it makes you sound, behave, and even look more beautiful. So we take on the roles that other people ascribe to us.
Since we have introduced gender, when you look at the kind of things we've been talking about, are there interesting or significant differences between men and women, or does that truly not matter very much?
I was really expecting there to be one. when we looked at these studies. And time again, there really isn't. And that was what really surprised me, was just how universal these forces are and just how they affect all of us in very, very, very similar ways. So we haven't seen any biases one way or another for men or women. My wife will tell you differently, but...
And if you look at other differences between people, say, as long as we're talking about adults, age, education, class background, all those kind of things, that all of this is something that seems to operate at a pretty fundamental level, and those other things don't make as much difference as perhaps we might think they might.
They don't. And the one interesting exception to that is culture.
Hmm.
And there's a guy at Stanford, actually, who did this experiment with basically had a cartoon of school fish. And the in the cartoon, there's a school of fish, and the one fish starts swimming ahead of the other fish. What he did is he showed that to both college students and high school students and adults all over the United States, and he asked them, can you explain what's happening here in this picture, or in this cartoon sequence? And said, yeah, of course, the one fish that's swimming ahead of the pack is stronger, faster, more capable. He's breaking ahead of the pack. Then he showed the exact same cartoon sequence to folks living in China. And he said, can you describe what's happening here? And he said, yes, this one fish who's swimming ahead was pushed away from the pack. He must have done something that angered the pack. He does not fit in. The pack is angry at him. Again, the exact same cartoon sequences, but two very different definitions of what happened. And when he showed the cartoons to people living in Hong Kong, they actually, half the people gave a Western definition and half the people gave a Eastern interpretation. And he was actually able to prompt people to give one or two explanations based on, he would just show him slides of, if he showed him slides of like McDonald's and Superman and stuff like that, they would have a Western interpretation. And if they showed him pictures of the Chinese flag or some Chinese religious symbols, then they would actually have an Eastern interpretation. So that culture actually plays a big role in terms of how we look at the world and how, even how we behave in groups and in rational and irrational ways.
You've talked about the fact that there is a basic, that basically humans are loss averse. We don't like to lose, and that sometimes as a result we will actually make bad decisions that will result in loss because we hate to lose. And you've there are plenty of illustrations for that. So you can see that as an individual, what people seem to want to do is maximize their own gains. But what does that, or is there something here that also says that it's not just enough that we succeed, we'd like to see other people fail? We really, you know, we not only do we want to win, but it makes us feel better if we win and somebody else loses, and so that might in fact work against the idea that human beings inherently, they kind of want to cooperate, they want to work together. Some people would make the argument that that's why human beings have been successful. In reality, in fact, when people are pitted one against another and there seems to be something at stake that they think is important, well, how does that work out?
Well, you know, I think a game show actually explains that in an interesting way. You know, who wants to be a millionaire? And one of the rules of the game, you ask all these questions, and one of the rules of the game is that if you're stuck, you can ask the audience. And it turns out that the audience, because there are so many of them, are exceptionally accurate in terms of predicting the real answer. And in America, people time and again poll the audience, and it helps them, and then it's a very good strategic thing to do. When the game was imported to different countries, specifically in Russia, people started giving when the audience was polled, they would purposefully give the wrong answer and trick the contestant. And you think, well, you know, are the Russians mean-spirited? Well, it's not exactly that. there is this element of fairness, and exactly what you're talking about, that it's, is it fair that this one guy playing should win a lot of money, $1 million, just because I helped him and I get nothing in return? That doesn't seem fair. So if he's not smart enough to know the answer by himself, let me trip him up. And that when you look at things through the lens of fairness, that we sometimes don't want people to get a free lunch off us. There is another illustration of this where two people were asked to, and this is universal, by the way, or virtually universal, people were asked to split a $10 bill or $20 bill, doesn't matter how much. And there was one person who was a splitter, and he could split it whichever way he wanted. And there was one person who was the chooser, and this person could either accept or deny the offer. And if they accepted the offer, everyone gets the money. And if they deny the offer, no one gets anything. And typically what people do is, let's say it's a $10 bill, they split it in halves and they say, I'll take $5, and that person accepts because it's a fair arrangement. But when the splitter becomes greedy and starts taking $6, $7, $8 for themselves, the receiving person turns down the offer. And from a rational economic perspective, $2 is better than nothing, right? You're never going to see this person again. They're a random stranger. You're never going to repeat this interaction again. You should walk away with anything that's offered to you. But you say, I'm going to sacrifice these $2 or $3 just so the other person can learn a lesson. And you think, well, you know, it's easy to walk away from $2 or $3, so they did the same experiment with $100. And again, people walk away from $40 because it's just not fair that the other person will get $60.
Yeah, to me, that sort of doesn't make sense. But that's sort of the point, that a lot of this doesn't make sense at a rational, on a rational level. And I mean, maybe also it's because it's me. If I was the person who was making the decision, I'd figure, well, you know, that's $50 I didn't have before. I'll take 50. The other person can have the 50. You know, why should I hold out for the idea that, well, maybe I should actually have 70 and the other person would only get 30?
From a rational perspective, right, when we're not in the situation, you look at these people and you say, how can they be so dumb, right? How can you walk away from $40?
Yeah.
But I think if I was in that situation, and despite the fact that I tend to think of myself as pretty rational, I think I would actually get swayed because I would get angry. I would have so much emotions about the guy that the guy is trying to screw me over that I'd get upset, and I can see myself walking away from those $40.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. I guess myself, I'm thinking, well, you know, if the choice is between $40 and nothing, I would say, to heck with my pride, I'll take the $40.
But, right, but it's not just $40 or nothing. It's $40, nothing, or teaching the other guy
a lesson. Yeah. which I suppose that is a powerful enough kind of drive.
Yeah. And I've been in situations like that, right, not involving splitting money, where you just want to teach someone a lesson, and you might... I might lose out in the process as well, but by gosh, I taught someone a lesson.
Yeah. Well, I suppose that, again, it just shows you that some sort of crude and basic notions of fairness enter into it. And I suppose it also has to do with crude and basic notions of self-esteem, you know, who I am, who that person is. And again, going back to this idea of what is winning and losing, and wanting to feel like one came out on top. Maybe in a psychological sense, you can say teaching that person a lesson, you do come out on top, even though you walked away from $40.
Right. And it's interesting that monkeys have the same reaction when they've done these experiments with monkeys. Hmm. They wanted to teach the other a lesson.
It's that basic. Even primates, who are no doubt closer to us than maybe we would really like to admit, even they have the same thing. Yeah, I'm going to teach this other monkey a lesson.
Absolutely, absolutely, and because it helps a society kind of move along, right? I mean, if normally, right, from evolutionary perspective, if someone takes advantage of you once, then chances are they'll do that again and again and again. You live with the same people over and over again, which is why we have these notions of fairness, right? If you all abide by the rules of fairness, then no tribe or community is going to do pretty well for itself. And if you no longer have rules of fairness, then things are going to really go awry. And that we bring that mentality to this experiment, although our rational mind knows, hey, this is a one-time exchange. We're never going to see this person again. You still have you're still trying to maintain fairness because it's so important for us as a species.
Well, that's interesting. It leads to this question do in fact these ways that we have of behaving and thinking that can be very irrational and in fact for us as individuals can mean bad decisions and possibly a loss, that those things actually, if you ask, well, what's really best for the group, that maybe we as an individual have a loss, but that somehow that works to the advantage of the over time to the group as a whole.
Right, and we tend to follow groups without realizing it. And there's one of the classical psychological studies involves 12 people in a room looking at lines of different lengths. And there's three lines, and then there's a fourth line. And what the participants were asked to do was match the fourth line with one of the three lines in terms of length. And there's no optical illusion here. It was pretty obvious. But one person after the other, people gave the wrong answer. And unbeknownst to that 12th participant, that last person, everyone else was an actor. And they were purposely told, to give the wrong answers. And when it came to their turns, a surprising majority of the time, more than 65% of the time, the participant gave the wrong answer as well. Because you just go with the group. In the beginning, the psychologists started thinking, well, you know, people are so easily manipulated and people don't have a sense of esteem. But neuro research, when you put people in MRI machines, shows that your perception of those lines actually changes once the group gives a different answer. So that it's not only that you're trying to go along with the group, that your actual perception changes just to satisfy the group. Because, again, it makes sense from a perception of we're a social animal, the group, you kind of want to go with the group a lot of the time.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, that's just another one of those things that shows you how it is, how difficult it is, and how unusual we should expect it would be for the people who are the outliers, who are the ones who have some idea about something or some way of going about something or some way of doing something that's completely different from everybody else. Those people are going to be rare, and it's not going to be easy for them to be the one person that says, no, you guys, I don't know what's wrong with you. This line is not like the other ones.
Right, and it's so difficult to take on that role. And what was interesting is that when you bring out a dissenter into these groups, and even if the dissenter is an actor, and even if the dissenter is completely incompetent, in one of the cases they had the dissenter wearing these thick glasses, and he pretended to be blind, and the glasses were so thick they actually had to shave them down so the actor wouldn't get too big of a headache. But even if the dissenter is sitting in that room and says, I'm completely blind, and gives an answer that's different from the rest of the group, that then psychologically allows the last participant to actually dissent as well. So only one person dissenting gives permission to that last person to dissent as well and actually give the right answer. So we have these people who play a role, we call them blockers, and that in organizations, blockers tend to get very quickly dismissed because they can just be a pain in the neck, right? They're always, oh, this isn't right, oh, this is never going to work. They're just fuddy-duddies, right? And when we don't have them in an organization or a company or even a family, then groups can sometimes go very quickly go on this groupthink, and that we need those dissenting voices to stay rational.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Ori Brafman. He is the co-author, along with his brother Ram Brafman, of the book Sway, The Irresistible Pull of Irrational Behavior. He is also the co-author of the book The Starfish and the Spider. He's well known as an organizational expert and regularly speaks before a lot of big companies, also governmental and military audiences. And he's talking with us by telephone. The book, by the way, Sway, published by Doubleday. It's out there in the bookstore now if you want to take a look at it. Questions, welcome. 833-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Have you found or have you thought about how it is that maybe people or organizations, and I'm not necessarily talking about sociopaths or con men, but maybe that is something that they understand too, that knowing that people do think this way, that it's used to get them to do things, to get them to buy things, and whatever, that it is intentionally used to sway people.
That's where marketing really comes into the equation. And one of the things we looked at was the story of a hot dog vendor in the turn of the century who had a really great recipe for hot dogs that his wife made. And not only was his recipe really delicious, he found a way of producing the hot dogs for half as much as what they were going for. So he opens up a hot dog stand in Coney Island, and he thinks that everyone's going to rush to him, right? The things cost only, they taste better and they cost half as much. And this guy named Nate realizes that no one's coming to visit his stand at all, right? It's just like crickets hanging around. And what he does is, whether consciously knowing about the psychological force or just playing around with the business idea, he gets a bunch of his friends who to wear doctor outfits, physician outfits, and stand by the cart. And what that did is it changed people's value attribution from these cheaper hot dogs that couldn't possibly be good to people thinking about it from, if it's good for a doctor, then it must be good for me. And all of a sudden his cart became very, very successful, and the hot dogs became Famous Nate's hot dogs. And what he did was he was able to tap into this core value attribution that we have. And I think other companies, modern companies, are able to do that as well in terms of, look, you think about products, for example, that might be the exact same product, but one of them looks so, for example, compare the iPod to Microsoft's Zune. And they're basically the same product, but Apple, seems cool, seems hip. You have that kind of, you diagnose it in that way, and it's hard to think of an iPod in any way except cool and hip. Mm-hmm. And you look at Microsoft's Zune, right, and it's perceived as, kind of lame and Microsoft and encumbered. And the products might be exactly the same, but once you have that bias, diagnostic bias on it, you can't think of it in any other way other than, it's kind of Microsoft and it's kind of, not very cool.
Well, I think that shows you the brilliance of the marketing campaign that Apple has been doing for a while now. The I'm a PC and I'm a Mac thing, that may already have been building on the kinds of images that people already had. But obviously, when you look at the two actors that they've hired to do that, who do you want to be? Well, there's no question here who it is. You don't want to be John Hodgman. You want to be, and I'm sure John is a fine guy. He's actually a very funny guy. You don't want to be John Hodgman. You want to be the other guy. That's a no. For most people, that's going to be a no-brainer. And of course, now Microsoft has tried to turn that around. And they have a new campaign where they have all kinds of people saying, I'm me, and this is what I do, and this is what I do in my life, and I'm a PC user, and, I'm not that other guy.
But even that, I think once you view Microsoft from the way of being very stodgy and kind of wearing that old brown suit, even those commercials are very, I don't know how well they've done, because you still are perceiving things from the point of view that Microsoft is stodgy, and it even plays true in politics. You think even 4 years ago, the tides really turned for Kerry once he was labeled a flip-flopper. And once you think about him as a flip-flopper, and the Republicans started calling him a flip-flopper in February, and for 6 months they kept on calling him a flip-flopper, and that 6 months afterwards, in August, when when the Swift vote campaign came out, I think that it would never have flown unless people already viewed Kerry is a flip-flopper. So he's saying, if he flip-flopped on his vote for on Iraq and on the economy and what have you, then certainly he must have flip-flopped on his service record in Vietnam. And that really is what cost him the campaign, that very strong diagnostic bias. And the same thing for the Apple-Microsoft thing, that once you see things in that perspective, you dismiss any evidence that contradicts your initial diagnosis.
We have a caller here, and let's get him in while we still have time. In Terre Haute, Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
I'm kind of curious as to why logic or logical or reason, why does logic need a prefix? Can you explain that to me, please? Thank you. I'll listen off the air or on the air.
All right. I don't know. Is the question clear?
I'm not exactly sure.
Well, I'm not exactly sure either, and the caller is hung up, so I don't know how to help you to respond. I don't even know how to help you to respond.
I think maybe what the caller is asking is, why is it that we even need to think to ourselves what's logical? Why isn't logic the first thing that comes to our mind?
Oh, why do we not just automatically think
in the logical way?
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a pretty good question. Why is that?
I think that it has to do with the fact that when we make decisions, there's different categories of how we make decisions. The first one is rational decisions, and a vast amount of decisions that we make are rational and are very logical. And then there's another category of decisions that are emotionally based. And, for example, when you decide to get married, that might not be a rational decision. It might have fantastic rational outcomes, but you're making that decision because you're in love with someone. You're not making that decision because you'll be able to fill out tax form 1054A better, right? And there's really also then a third category of decision-making factors, which are what we call these sways or these hidden psychological forces. And that when these work on you, you think that you're acting rationally, or you think that you're acting logically, but you're really not. And that's why we need to sometimes step back and say, would logic in the situation really dictate that I do X, or am I being swayed by something else? Because you know when you're being emotional.
Mm. Well, we're coming down to the point here. We have 2-3 minutes left, and I guess we're left with this question that, given that these kind of forces that we have been talking about are powerful and they operate often below our level of awareness, that is, they're working on us and we're really not conscious of that fact, then can we ever hope to get around that or at the very least try to bump them up to the level so we would say, well, at least I'm aware that I'm thinking in this way? And it gives you the opportunity to say, am I making the right choice here? What's influencing my choices and so forth?
So with loss aversion, which is what we started off with, that is that we overreact to losses, the best thing to do is to take a long-term perspective. And that whether you're a pilot or a stock investor, having that long-term perspective tends to ease that loss aversion away from us, and that we start looking at things much more rationally. Another thing to do is that once we're aware of the biases, we've just been talking about value attribution, right? Once you're aware of, there's really no difference between, logically, there's no difference between a Zune and an iPod, that power ceases to have hold on us. And it's really interesting how it no longer has an effect on us once we're conscious that it's present. So if you're in the subway, rather than looking at the guy's clothes, try to listen to the music and say, you know what, if I would listen to the music objectively, would it matter whether I'm in Carnegie Hall or in the subway? For organizations, a really big help is to have dissenting voices, and that once you have a tension between people and in terms of decision making, that we tend to make much better decisions when our assumptions are continually questioned. So with each one of these forces, there are ways to counteract them. The first thing is to just be aware of them, but it's also about once you're aware of them, saying, here is a specific mental or logical tool that I can use in order to avoid that pull.
It seems that, to encourage, particularly if we're talking about the individual level, encouraging people to think that way, it's not impossible. I'm certain that there are people who are like that, but it also seems to me that that one would be asking people to have an almost superhuman kind of detachment, the ability to step back, to step out of the situation and to say, wait, let's look at this thing rationally and see if, what are the choices here and what choice am I about to make, and is that the best choice for me? It seems to me, at the very least, very, very difficult, if not almost impossible.
There is a certain level of zen involved, isn't there?
Exactly.
And again, time and again, I continually find myself in situations where I just totally fell into this trap, and that you're right that you can't at all times be removed. And I don't think that it's logical to think of ourselves as being like Spock, but knowing how we're going to react in certain ways, and knowing that ahead of time of situations, for example, if we're conducting a job interview, chances are people are typically terrible at performing job interviews because they take the wrong information into account. Or if you're even visiting a doctor, or if you're buying a stock, saying, you know what, here are the biases I'm going to fall into. Let me just at least be somewhat mindful of it, that when it's happening, that we might be able to catch ourselves.
All right. There we'll have to leave it. The book is Sway, The Irresistible Pull of Irrational Behavior, published by Doubleday, by our guest Ori Brofman and his brother Ram. And Mr. Brofman, thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me, David. It was really an interesting conversation.